Hey, Kelsey.
Hey, Brooke.
Want to tell everyone what's happening in today's episode?
Today's episode, we are going to be talking about the French Revolution and asking ourselves whether women benefited from it.
Interesting. Yeah. All right, let's get into it.
Hello, and welcome to Remedial Her Story, The Other 50%, the podcast that explores what happened to the women in history class. Now, here's your host, Kelsey Brooke Eckert, and her partner in crime, Brooke Neva Sullivan.
All right, so Brooke, French Revolution immediately follows the American Revolution in time, and it is arguably the most significant revolution of this period of revolutions in world history, because it lays the groundwork, it reframes Europe, right? Napoleon at the end of this nonsense goes and invades everyone.
Yep.
And it also brings conversations about equality and liberty and equal rights, and recognizing citizens as, you know, citizens, right, to Europe. You know, these same conversations that are happening in U.S. are happening in Europe, and arguably more so. That's our U.S. centrism that tells us otherwise. And it's just such an important thing. And I think a lot of people, a question I hear framed a lot in world history classes is whether or not the revolution was successful and if it actually achieved its ends.
The French Revolution.
The French Revolution, yeah. And I think that's a great question to investigate because there's so many things that happen over the course of the French Revolution that kind of go against the goals of the very revolution. You know, the revolutionaries themselves betray their ends. And I think that's an interesting, you know, I think it's interesting and worth getting into. But of course, I want to know how all of this impacted women.
Sure.
And before we get into that too much, today I just want to introduce this idea that talking about women, I don't think this is introduction if you've been listening to the podcast long enough, but
if someone's new to the podcast, here you go.
Here's the same thing. Just because we're framing it and centralizing women's experience does not mean this is a niche topic or question.
Right.
Women are half of us. And if the French Revolution screws over half of us,
then they should be talked about.
Then it was not successful.
Yeah.
And it was interesting when I brought this up with my students, the amount of, like, you could see the elevated feeling.
Like of the angst.
The angst of, I don't want to call anybody out in particular, but like male students had a really hard time processing that. And so I ended up breaking down and redefining the patriarchy in class. This is not against men.
Right.
Because when we break it down, if the French Revolution, and I think you'll find that the French Revolution really benefited elite men, right? It removes
dudes with money.
The monarchy, sure. It removes nobility, sure, and those loyal to the monarchy.
The throne. Yeah.
You know, in the Reign of Terror, they are executed. And then it replaces those people with a new set of elite men, people that had been right on the precipice, right?
Yeah.
Wealthy men, merchant men, right?
Landowners.
Those people who it benefits this next tier of elite men.
Yeah, they're like, move aside. We want to be the top.
Yeah. And so when you, the French Revolution ultimately ends slavery within the French Empire, but that takes a while. And
weird.
Shocking. So I guess my point overall is we're talking about a very small percentage of men who benefited from the French Revolution.
And a huge population of men that fought for it that were not of that class.
That did not benefit.
And women
didn't benefit. People of color who are enslaved in the empire did not benefit for a long time. And so if most people did not benefit for a long time, then what the hell are we talking about? Do you know what I'm saying?
Was it a revolution or was it just a moving of the guard?
Right. That is the patriarchy. It's not men are the problem. It's patriarchy is a system.
Right.
A social system that is a hierarchy that benefits elite men. So reframing this question to center the experiences of women actually benefits the vast majority of people living in the French Empire. And even if it didn't benefit men, women are half of the goddamn humanity, you know? So asking this question is not a niche topic. It's not an interest group. It's half of the people involved in this revolution.
You mean France wasn't only men? I know, this is shocked. Shocked. You've blown me away yet again, Kelsey.
We're going to get into it today.
Okay. French Revolution.
Before we do that, I want to do a little business update because it is giving season. It is, we are business coming
update
up
in the corner. Someday we'll come up with a good theme song,
a little ditty. But no, I think this is such an important, I mean, this lesson plan that what we're going to talk about today, we have a lesson plan about it. It's available for free on our website.
It's free?
Free, free, free. It involves primary sources, which I'm going to reference. I'm going to even read portions of today. I know.
You guys.
Yeah.
Luxury.
Luxury. And I'm going to walk you through how I teach it to my students and would teach it to even younger students in schools.
You're going to do this all for free?
For free. Ka-ka. But all of that, all having all these resources for free for educators costs us a lot.
Yeah. And we got to warehouse it. We got to write them. We got to pay people. We got to do all the things and promote it.
Yeah. And so whatever is a significant amount to you on a monthly basis would make a huge difference to our organization and keep these things coming for free.
Yeah.
On our website under remedialherstory.com/giving, there is an opportunity to become a monthly giver, a donor, and you'll join many people who do that every month and support this work. Because this is, I mean, if they're like, this is a feminist cause, right?
Yeah.
To remind people that women are half of us.
So one way I was thinking about it the other day of donations and doing these things. And so there's like a $7 Patreon, you know, you can be, which is like the lowest level or something like that.
Five even.
Five. So that $5 helps us keep the website going.
Yep.
That website then gives a lesson plan to one teacher. That one teacher then teaches it to 25 students or more.
Yeah.
You know, and then the snowball keeps going. So your small $5 impacts significantly to the outreach and the availability that we have to the teachers.
And we have thousands of educators on our website.
Every day.
Every day. And so your impact is so big, it's like hard to even quantify.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think of like, you know, when you think about a ripple and you making a ripple, each person has that ability to make the waves in the water and the water reaches the shore and the shore can keep going. So it's like you can just do that with $5, which is, I don't know that you can make that much impact on other things for that little amount of money.
Yeah. Yep. I know. So remedialherstory.com/giving. Please join the many people who do that.
It I know. Thank you to our patrons.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you to the many patrons who continue to support us. And, you know, I hope you'll join them.
Okay. Do-do-do-do-do. Business update over.
Woohoo.
Back to your regular scheduled programming.
So I want to give some, you know, we can't do the French Revolution. This is decades of time in a brief podcast episode.
Kelsey.
I know, shocking. So
I was ready to get cozy here.
I'm going to just like drop some nuggets for people to explore further. We also have an article about the Enlightenment on our website that people can look at. And I guess starting framing the French Revolution like the American Revolution under sort of the Enlightenment concept is a obviously central because that's when this is happening. And it's these ideas that are really motivating a population of people to be revolutionary. Things that are, I think, because of male centrism in our society and in our history classes, even though, like when you say revolutionary, people, when they close their eyes and they picture a revolutionary, it's usually a male figure doing, you know, war, arms up, you know, rah. And
you say that, and then immediately in my mind, I have that like painting of the female with like tattered clothing.
Yeah. That's from the French Revolution, right? That painting. So that painting actually is a great way to sort of begin, you know, liberty, that woman leading the people in the French Revolution is a way presenting that image and actually calling out her gender and specifically calling out that this is a woman, this is a female figure doing it, is significant. And to contrast it with other images that we've talked about, like, you know, the Manifest Destiny painting, that woman is symbolic, right? She's representing mm-hmm. westward expansion, U.S. imperialism, that sort of thing. Liberty in the French painting is representing liberty. So she is sort of symbolic. But the storming of the Bastille, one of the first events of the French Revolution, there actually was a woman at the front of the crowd.
Cool.
And that, I think, because when we think of war as sort of men's business and attacking a government building as men's business, if that's our like baseline, when women are present, our mental framework for these things erases them, even when they are there in history. Right. So
that's our own bias.
Yeah. So people are all wrapped up in this political fervor. Women are creating these political clubs in the decades leading up to the revolutions. I say revolutions, American, French, you know, so Haitian, so on and so forth. And these kind of elite women are at these salons having these conversations, engage, you know, they're getting people like, you know, Rousseau to come and talk to them and like teach them about stuff. And so there's this, women are part of it. They're
in the weeds.
They're facilitating it. You know, some of the best, the hostesses of these salons, of these, you know, political conversations and scientific conversations are these female figures. And it's just real. They're so fascinating and interesting.
Well, and they also have a high level of influence in their home with their husbands who they're, you know, trying to charge up as well.
Yeah. And then there's a long list of women's political clubs that are being formed in France in the decades leading up to the revolution and then definitely during the revolution. So women feel part of it. Mm-hmm. When, after the Bastille is stormed and men in the French Revolution create a list of demands, they form an assembly, essentially a congress, and they say, you know, we have these demands that the government recognize a congress of the people, of the citizens, of the lower classes. And we want a substantial vote in government affairs, right? In creating policy, tax codes, all of that stuff. And the way it was there was these three estates. So the clergy, the nobility, and the everyone else who represented like 99% of the population, and they all had an equal vote, right? So the clergy, who represent like less than 1% of the population, get a vote. The nobility, who represent less than 1% of the population, get a vote, and then the rest of them got one vote, right? And that's just a really unfair system. There's a great political cartoon, all men, of course, but the cartoon that I love to use to introduce the French Revolution to my students, because, you know, visuals are key and so helpful and speak louder than words, is this cartoon. Brooke, you've got it in front of you. What's happening?
There's this little old man. I think he's holding a paintbrush, looks like, or a cane. What is that?
It's a plow for working the land. Plow.
Yeah. Okay, he's hunched over and sitting. Yeah. So, like, he's hunched over like he's playing horsey, and there's like two childlike figurines with their men, their adults, sitting on top of him like they're riding a horsey.
Yeah, so this poor old guy representing, you know, the common man.
Okay, so he's common. Tattered. And then the people on top, there's one with a gray wig, so I'm imagining clergy.
Yeah.
And the other one has very ornate clothing, which I'm imagining is royalty.
Yeah. Yep. So, and I think it just illustrates how they are, you know, literally riding on the backs of the poor.
Great imagery.
And I think it just explains the conditions of French people during this time. And I also love this as a hook to introduce the experiences of women, because so no women had feelings about this. No elite women benefited from this.
It's even funnier at the garb that the men are wearing, because it's very feminine.
To us in our modern sense, yeah.
In our modern minds.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. So that's the situation. And it's bad. I mean, the French backed the Americans in the revolution.
And they sent us supplies and people. And
General Lafayette.
Lafayette.
And that tanked the French treasury. And
it did. And then when they asked for help for us to go over there, we're like, but we just survived ours.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So they are in a debt issue, a debt crisis. And instead of looking to the clergy and the nobility who owned the vast majority of the land to fix it, they created an unfair tax code, shocking, and put it on the people.
Just like sounds so reminiscent of the Tea Party.
Yes. There's also some, you know, kind of an environmental crisis that occurs. It's kind of a cold period and the crop didn't grow. And so there's a bread crisis. And one of the most significant events of the French Revolution is when a group of women organized. I say organized because there's sort of this idea that it was a spontaneous, like, let's just go. And like, they do that to women all the time, as if women can't, like, have you ever seen women organize? Like, they are the most organized people ever. They don't spontaneously do anything.
Majority of the title event planner is held by a woman.
Right. HR.
Female.
Yeah.
So I've yet to meet an event planner that is male.
These women organize themselves, and one of them has a drum, and they march through the streets of Paris banging this drum during and create essentially a bread protest. And they are gathered, throngs of people join them, men included.
Is this in Paris?
In Paris. And they march to the Palace of Versailles, which is a long way to walk, to march a crowd of people.
If you've never been to Paris, it's not exactly in the city.
Yeah. So they are marching all the way out to the palace where the king is basically in hiding because of the tension that is in the air, and his family. And they arrive at the palace and they demand an audience with the king. And the king lets a few women come in. There's an interesting story. One of the people selected to go meet with the king and share the position of the mob is a teenage girl who apparently, when she sees him, faints because she's just like, oh my God, it's the king, and like is done.
It's like a celebrity.
Yeah. I don't know why they selected that person in particular to represent them.
But well, she's probably the number one fan. Maybe she had a shirt that she wanted him to sign.
I don't think so, because she joined a mob of people that were very angry.
I know, and she was like, if I join this mob, I'll finally get to meet him.
Was she like a Swiftie or something?
Yeah, totally. It's definitely a Swiftie fan. That's funny. Well, so we have a first account of that story?
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
So there's lots of resources about that.
So how does the bread riot end?
So it's actually very successful. They get the king to come back to Paris. That's one of their demands. Like, you can't hide in your estate out here. Like, no. Come back to Paris and deal with the people, you know? So they get him to come back. That's one success. The other thing is they...
Sorry, and who's the king at this time? I'm blanking.
King Louis the 16th, and he's married to Marie Antoinette.
That's right. Let them eat cake is her famous. That she never said.
Well, that's kind of not a real thing. There's some debate about whether she actually said that. But so he's the king, and he and his family return to Paris. And the other successful accomplishment of this riot is that they come back with carts of bread from the king's kitchens to feed to the people. And there's promises of even more bread. So things seem...
Would you say that they're no longer sour about the dough?
Stop it.
And the riot was over.
Oh, my Lord. So I can't with you. So the... bread riot is successful, but things are still really tense, and the king is also in this really challenging dynamic, because he the nobility have a vote, the clergy have a vote, and he's trying to get the clergy and the nobility to make some concessions to the people. They're not on board, and he is...
Oh, interesting that he was even trying to make concessions.
He is trying to make some concessions. I'm not an expert on like all the things that he did or could have done. But I do know that there are attempts on his behalf to meet the needs of the people. And honestly, he pays a huge price, which we'll get into. The revolution, I'm gonna skip a lot in time here for the sake. But, you know, things continued to be tense. You know, peasants in the countryside take up arms against the nobles that are local to them. There are, you know, sort of like smaller armed conflicts. And eventually the king and Marie Antoinette try to escape to Austria to be with Maria Theresa, or to be where her family is from. Maria Theresa is her mom. Maria Theresa is dead at this point. But we do have an episode on Maria Theresa that folks should look back at from season two. And so they try to flee and they're captured en route. And this sort of begins a new period of the French Revolution. So there's sort of this like tense, skirmishy, negotiating-y period. And then there's this period of known as the Reign of Terror. And it really begins with the capture of the king and the queen and their children and them being put on trial, tried for treason, and executed by the guillotine.
Yikes.
And, you know, crowds of people come and cheer for the execution of the king. And then later, months later, the queen. And I can't even imagine what it would have been like to be Marie Antoinette in this prison, knowing your husband has just been executed. And like,
well, and she's grown up in privilege. She's grown up in a life of luxury. Yeah, never, also, never knowing what the people have experienced or why they hate her so much.
Right. And also like, not the person in power.
Yeah, has nothing to do with this other than being married to this man.
Yeah. Her life is complicated and interesting, and not to say that she was a great person, but just like that would have been awful.
But also to kill off any of the heirs too, which was a big moment as well.
So 40,000 people are killed during the Reign of Terror, which is
40,000
people. And so, you know, it's known as the Reign of Terror because there are trials happening, big air quotes.
Like, yeah.
And these people are, you know, seen as connected to the monarchy, proponents of the monarchy, and those people need to go. Mm. And that's like, this is not open political thought, open, you know, enlightenment thinking. This isn't, you know, fair trials by your peers. No, this is terror.
Get them up, get them out. Yep. We're done.
We're done with this. And Maximilian Robespierre is sort of the main perpetrator of this with his committee of safety that's trying to promote safety. For who, I wonder. This is sort of under the Reign of Terror is where, you know, you I mentioned, like, we've got women's political clubs. We've got women leading the charge on the Bastille. We've got women leading the bread riot that results in the king coming back to Paris and getting bread distributed to the people, the families that these women are trying to feed, right? Reign of Terror is the end of that for women. It's the introduction of terror for women. Mm. And it is a huge turning point for women, largely. In the middle of the revolutionary period, the men issue a Declaration of Independence, essentially, a Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen. And one of the women revolutionaries at this time is a woman named Olympe de Gouges. And she's a figure who has been so lost.
Sorry. Say that name again.
Olympe, like Olympic, Olympia.
Oh, Olympe.
Olympe in French, oui. And de Gouges is her last name.
Okay. So I'm with you.
Okay, so Olympe de Gouges, right? You gotta let it go.
I can't. So funny.
Do you speak French?
Clearly no.
Not.
Okay. No.
Olympia.
I know how to ask.
Should I save Olympia just for your Americanization?
I took American French all through high school. All I know is how to ask to go to the bathroom. Okay. So that tells you about my French experience.
Okay. Olympe.
De Gouges.
De Gouges. Oui.
Oui.
Okay.
Pomfrites.
She issues the Declaration of the Rights of Women and Citizeness.
Citizeness. I've never heard it feminized that way.
Yes. Well, in French and Spanish, you must have
feminine accent. Yes. I got you.
Oui. So if the Frenchmen plagiarized the American Declaration of Independence, she basically copies their list of grievances against the king and says, yeah, all that stuff.
For
that
the ladies.
That you're asking for, but for the ladies as well. It's also a massive, this document that she publishes is also just this feminist call to arms. She ends the document with this short passage. Women, wake up. The Tocsin of Reason sounds throughout the universe. Recognize your rights. The powerful empire of nature is no longer surrounded by prejudice, fanaticism, superstition, and lies. The torch of truth has been dispersed, and all the clouds of folly and usurpation. Enslaved man has multiplied his force and needs yours to break his chains. Having become free, he has become unjust towards his companion. Yes. So she's saying these same men that are asking for their freedom have now become unjust towards the women, their companions, who are right there next to them. She says, oh, women, women, when will you cease to be blind? What advantages have you gathered in the revolution? A scorn more marked, a disdain more conspicuous. During the centuries of corruption, you only reigned over the weakness of men. Your empire is destroyed. What is left to you then? Firm belief in the injustices of men.
It's powerful.
So there's a bit more to it, but it is a powerful, powerful document. Lynn Hunt republished this in a collection of documents called The French Revolution and Human Rights, a brief documentary history, and you could collect that there. You can also get it in our lesson plan. Also living in this time is perhaps the most famous feminist thinker of the Enlightenment period, Mary Wollstonecraft.
Oh, yeah.
She's an English woman who is living in France because this is where all the women's political thought is happening, all the salons are, all of that.
Well, and it's more of a liberal state than what the UK is at that time, too.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many interesting thoughts.
Art, and literature. Women are reading at a ferocious rate.
And
I mean,
she writes a really important document. Yes, yes. She writes a really important document called The Vindication of the Rights of Women. This document is a bit different. You know, Olympe de Gouges is advocating for political equality for women. Mary Wollstonecraft is like steps behind that in terms of where like her forward-thinking feminism in that she's sassy. She is sassy. She says, my own sex, I hope, will excuse me if I treat them as rational creatures, right? So she's like, please, like, can we just be, like, accept that women are rational and, you know, can move on here? But, so she is sassy. I don't want to say that she's not, but she's advocating really basically, and then there's more to it, but can we just educate women equally so that they can participate in these democracies?
What a novel idea.
Right? Because if you're not educated, it's really hard to have an educated vote. It's hard to justify that. So we need in these societies, if we're going to have these more enlightened societies, women need educations in them. And so she's living in that time. Mary Wollstonecraft, when the Reign of Terror happens, flees France. She gets the heck out of there.
Well, yeah. She's like, not my war. No. Not my zoo, not my monkeys.
Right. So I think that illustrates just how scary this time was for women who were political thinkers. Olympe de Gouges gets a bit trapped. In the government in 1793, they begin to discuss all these women's clubs and these political women, and the entirely male government gets together and decides, should we keep having these women's clubs? And I'm sure we can all guess how that goes.
It's not great. They don't adopt it and they give them badges.
Right.
So surprising.
One of the, I want to put this in proper sort of international context. As the Reign of Terror is happening, King, Queen executed, pretty much all of the neighboring countries around France
freaking out.
The monarchies surrounding them declare war on France.
And so they're taking full advantage of this moment.
Yeah. But also, like, they need to protect their monarchies, right? They don't want this concept to spread. Well,
France at this time was a huge power.
Yeah.
Like Spain and England.
Yeah.
I mean, they were high up there on the list.
So, but these monarchies do not want this mob violence, which is how they see it, to spread to their countries, and they want to show to their people, if you try this, everyone's coming for you, you know.
Yeah.
So women in France are pragmatically responding to this. Okay, we're just throwing it out there. We're at war with everyone around us. I think we need a draft, one. Two, I think you should recruit women into that draft. Let women fight on behalf of the revolution. and arming women soldiers. So this is like how progressive women's ideas are in this time. So some women's political clubs are talking about arming women soldiers. So Jean-Baptiste Amar proposes a decree that basically would cease and silence all women's political clubs. And on October 30th, 1793, they get together to discuss this. The discussion is relatively brief, and they vote and unanimously pass this with, it says the decree passed with no discussion. And it basically is the end of women's political clubs and involvements and participation, because they're not invited to be at the assemblies. They're not invited to whatever. So that's 1793, squashed. All this amazing thinking that women were doing. Then they begin to put these sort of women on trial. And on November 3rd, 1793, just a month later after that decree, Olympe de Gouges is put on trial. She's accused of treason because she dedicated, this is kind of an interesting irony. So here's a woman who in the revolutionary period says, yeah, all that stuff you're asking for men, all those freedoms, all that equality, but give it to women too. So she is arguably more forward thinking than the male revolutionaries. She's more revolutionary, right, than them, because she's extending it to the other 50% of the population. But she makes a choice when she initially published that years before, to dedicate her declaration to Queen Marie Antoinette, because she was hoping that Marie Antoinette would see this issue.
Like as a thread connecting them.
Yeah, connecting the experiences of women across class, right? And
Clever.
However, they used that to say that she was a monarchist. That Olympe de Gouges was a monarchist.
Ouch.
Because she dedicated it to Marie Antoinette. Olympe de Gouges leaves Paris. You could argue she flees Paris, but she gets out and goes to her country estate. Her son was actually fighting in the French armies and was home at that time. So she went to be with him. And even though she's there, they come and they arrest her and they bring her back to Paris and they imprison her in Paris.
Thanks.
While awaiting trial, Olympe de Gouges is in prison, and you would think that a woman who's been told, like, hey, so the Reign of Terror is happening, people are being executed like wildfire, you know, at the guillotine, you should probably like stop saying things that could get your head chopped off. And Olympe de Gouges does not do that.
Well, yeah, she has a cause. She's believing in the thing.
She keeps publishing. She keeps writing rants about...
As great men have always done. Yes. Like, they don't care that they're in jail.
Nope.
Can't keep me down. I'm here for the cause.
She keeps writing. She keeps writing. And she's eventually put on trial. We have her trial transcript in our lesson plan, which you can read with students. I think it's really illustrative of the kind of toxic nature of the Reign of Terror documents. And I think this also, right, I said at the beginning of this episode, just because you're centering women's experiences does not mean it doesn't connect to the whole larger thing, right? When you say to students, these trial, quote unquote, trials during the Reign of Terror are bogus, Olympe de Gouges' trial illustrates that.
Yeah.
For men and women, anybody who is put on trial during this period. And there's very little discussion. There's very little evidence presented. She's not allowed to present very much evidence. Like a lot of women in this time, she basically says, like, no, don't execute me. Like, I'm pregnant. And so they get a doctor to come in and actually inspect her to make sure, to see if she's actually pregnant, and she's not pregnant.
Good try though.
Good try. They accuse her of treason, and she is executed. Olympe de Gouges does, like I've already illustrated, at her execution, is standing on the platform going, avenge me, right? Like, whoa, to the crowd of people. Like, this woman goes down fighting in the way that an intellectual
revolutionary should go down.
Yes. So she is an icon. And I think she's so important to highlight because when she dies, a lot of her documents, her writing gets lost and buried in the Reign of Terror period. And so a lot of people, when they think about feminists of the Enlightenment period, they focus on Mary Wollstonecraft mm-hmm. because she survived.
Well, and she probably, you know, has more out post Reign of Terror of yes. how that happened.
Although she does die in childbirth shortly after, but she has, you know, a husband and now a daughter who can, you know, get her documents republished, refocus that. There's also a scandal because her daughter was born out of wedlock, and so that. Kind of like that negative publicity that comes from her scandalous yep. personal life actually benefits her because people know her name. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yep.
So, I mean, it doesn't benefit her reputation in Britain at the time, but it certainly benefits her readership. Alumte de Gouges, though, is like such a force, and everyone should know her name in schools. When people ask, so if the question is, was the French Revolution successful for women? Women's political clubs, all that amazing activity that you see before and during the beginnings of the revolution are squashed in 1793 with a decree that silences them and bans them from existing. Then Alumte de Gouges and many, many other women like her. There are lists of names that you could pull. Women like her who are publishing very progressive ideas that extend all these freedoms to women. They are executed in the Reign of Terror. Mary Wollstonecraft flees France. And if that's the painting of what the revolution was like, the end of the revolution was like for women, the answer is a hard no.
Yeah, no kidding.
Many people who've studied the revolution know that about a decade later, this chaos continues. Napoleon comes to power. There's many events that happen in there. So a decade later.
I was like, wait, we're going that far? Okay.
Yeah. Napoleon comes to power in a coup and seizes power, declares himself emperor. And that could be, you know, you could point to that in a general sense as the sort of end to revolutionary ideas, because we're not really in a democracy anymore, right? We're in an empire with an emperor who is, you know, all powerful. And if you look at paintings of Napoleon when he becomes emperor, like, he just looks like a god on this
throne. Oh my gosh.
You know, he takes France to war against their enemies, and he, you know, invades everybody and, you know, tries to get all the way to Moscow, and eventually is defeated there, mostly because he runs out of supplies and food, and people die in the cold of, you know, Russia, which is cold, fun fact. But Napoleon issues, during his time, a civil code that it goes wherever Napoleon's armies go. So it's a series of laws. These laws are really important. They abolish slavery, which is probably a good thing.
Yeah.
They get rid of feudalism. They do a lot of really great things for the places that his laws essentially accomplish a lot of the goals that the revolution had set forth: to get rid of this unequal economic system. So that's great. But when you center it on women's experiences, the code of laws does something yeah. that does not exist in the United States. So if you contrast his code with the US Constitution or other things where women's status is incredibly vague, right?
Right.
There's no mention of women in the entire US Constitution. They refer to man regularly. The pronouns used are he, him.
Right.
So you can read between the lines with who the founding fathers meant. But, you know, he, him, man are also used as universal terms. And so later when women are demanding their rights, that's the argument made by most people. And that's generally what's accepted today, is that when they say man is made, you know, blah, 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 they mean mankind.
Right.
Citizens. And obviously that took American suffragists decades to accomplish, but that the ambiguity of that is what allowed American women to eventually get their rights. So the Napoleonic codes could not be more different, because they pinpoint women's subordination.
Okay.
Whereas in the US, women's subordination is vague. In France, that is not the case.
It's very transparent.
Yeah, it's very transparent. So there's a section that says of the rights and respective duties of husband and wife. They, you know, mutually owe each other fidelity, succor, and assistance. The husband owes protection to his wife, so that's a plus. But the wife owes obedience to her husband. That's in law.
Ew.
So if you are not obedient to your husband, there's a law that says you have to be.
Yeah, good luck.
Okay. She is obliged to live with her husband. So if her husband's abusive, she has to live with him under law. Okay. If he's manipulative, she has to live with him under law. She has to, quote, follow him wherever he may think proper to dwell. The husband is bound to receive her, to furnish her with everything necessary for the purposes of life. So that means like food, clothing. You can like
just imagine these men creating these things. They're like, this is great. Women will be psyched about this.
Yeah, because we're going to protect him, feed him, clothe him. What's the problem?
Like, what more do they need?
Yeah. And you know, I know that in the U.S., I don't know if this is true in France, but in the U.S., there is an expectation of men that they are furnishing clothing and feeding their wives. And there are ways that when, like, women can, if they can prove that their husband is not doing that, they can get money for it.
Wow.
Which is that, so that's a plus, right? Because that is, you know, it's built into the law as well that husbands are bound to do, they have to do that, right? That's part of the contract. It says the wife can do no act in law without the authority of the husband, even if she is the public trader. So if it's her business,
she can't conduct it without a man.
She can't have, he has to be the legal signer on everything.
You can imagine marriages at this time, you know, the business deals that you'd be doing. It's like, well, yeah, if I marry her, she has a shipping company.
Yep.
It is now mine.
It is my shipping company. It is my, you know, seamstresses would have been an incredibly valuable.
Oh, yeah. We did a whole episode on work that women could do or were allowed to do in this time.
So it's just like, it is just appalling the degree to which their subordination is built in here. And then I think the last one is the greatest insult. The provisional administration of the children shall remain with the husband. And so that's the other thing is, even if she had the bravery to flee her husband, even if she had the willpower to you know, challenge his authority over her business and all of those things, the children are his. And he can take her kids from her at any minute.
Yikes.
So.
That's terrifying.
That is, I think. So if the decree in 1793 isn't sort of the
catalyst
of if Olympe de Gouges execute and the many other women in the Reign of Terror who like dared to speak. If, you know, Mary Wollstonecraft fleeing France isn't enough evidence. These laws, which spread everywhere France goes, are evidence that this revolution is so bad for women. And because of where they were before the revolution, right? Yeah. All those clubs, that thinking.
My mind is immediately going to, now that you've kind of given us all this context, my mind goes to, you were saying your students, when you're talking through this, were like, kind of disgruntled about women.
Well, because they're like, yeah. I mean, but that was like, I think they have the like there's so much like, yeah, but that's just how it was for women.
Yeah, and they're like cool with it.
And I'm like, and isn't that awful? And isn't that awful? You know, like, yeah, can, like, we follow that up with?
Yeah, stretch it.
And contrast it with British women, American women. This is worse.
Oh, yeah.
This is worse because, you know, in America, there are laws like this on the books, but it's different state to state.
Yep.
Right? And
there's not an empire running.
This isn't that big, right? And there are often protections built in there for women. The realities of frontier states are so different than coastal states. And women had a lot more rights out there. And where there's sort of that like contrast, women can make arguments. Yep. Why is it that women in Wyoming can do stuff that women in New York can't do stuff, do, you know? Like, and so those kind of, there's still opportunity there.
It's Napoleon's code is the whole country.
This is it. This is what we're doing. Boom. Right. And these codes stay in place into the 20th century. Yikes. French women are among the last women to get the right to vote in world history, or in Western history. And that
they
just
do have universal child care. Just
There's a win.
There are some things they do a little differently. But yeah, no, it
has long-lasting effects.
It sets the tone, which can help you understand the succession of the next phases after Napoleon from there going forward. So, yeah.
And I'm skipping over, you know, there's a June uprising. You know, there's lots of things that happen afterwards. And, you know, there's a return of the monarchy, another rebellion against the monarchy. You know, there's all that sort of stuff. But because the French Revolution is not brief. But I think these events sort of illustrate the realities of these experiences for women. And certainly elite women might have benefited from some of this stuff because they had all the privileges of being wealthy and elite.
And probably educated.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But they, you know, were given no platforms for
speech.
And it's, yeah. Centering this, I think, brings up questions, because then if this is true for women, what effect does this have on poor men? And then we can investigate
that. And then men of color. And then you can keep going.
Yeah. And then I think, you know, and to the point I made at the beginning, like, if you can't accept that if the revolution is terrible for half of the population, then it's terrible overall, then we've got issues.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
And merchant men are benefiting, and I guess their wives are benefiting from the wealth that those sort of next tier men are getting. But, you know, women in the nobility are losing, women,
certainly that
intellectual
are,
women are losing, poor women are losing. Like, this is,
it's widespread.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Kelsey. So we can find this on the website.
On the website, yeah.
Really interesting. And the images are awesome.
Yeah.
So certainly encourage people to go check those out. I think it's a great way to bring kids in.
Yeah. And we've centered the French Revolution in the larger Enlightenment period. And you can read that article on our website.
Great. Well, thanks, Kelsey.
Thanks, Brooke.
See you next time.
Thanks so much for listening to Remedial Her Story, The Other 50%. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to your podcasts to bring more voices to the conversation. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.